is in the whole world, that whole world and all the people would be, what we can say, will commit lots of sins, and people became like criminals, sinful, going astray and being in the wrong path, in the wrong way.
Yes.
And being ignorant of the hereafter life, of divine, let's say, rulings and, let's say, divine kind of guidance, satanic kind of ideas, ideologies, instructions will be followed at the end of this world. And then there would be lots of wars, conflicts, battles among the nations, among the people, killing, massacring each other. This sort of crisis will be there. And then Dajjal, the evil kind of figure, will reappear in this world, who will be, of course, again, the very worst and the very, let's say, horrifying criminal kind of figure, who will come and start bloodshedding and also killing, massacring, committing great and major sins in this world. Catastrophes, masaib, difficulties, challenges, problems will be a lot, will increase.
Yes.
And the people suffer from them. Khuruj al-Sufyani, and then these are some of the things that are mentioned.
Yes.
And there would be a kind of very loud and we can say even also horrifying kind of sound that will
yes.
be heard from the sky.
Okay.
That is called the heavenly kind of voice
yes.
will be heard by the people.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Baqiyatullahi khayrun lakum in kuntum mu'minin. Wama
we say, Allahumma ij'alni min ansarihi wa a'wanihi. O Allah, make me from among his helpers and from among his ansar and a'wan, meaning is his close helpers, and even if I'm not there, then at least the ones who are his assistants. I want to be part of that movement. The ones who come and come around him. The ones who hurry to meet any need that he has. Any need that he has, I want to be the one who fulfills his need. And I want to be among those who follow his commands and protect him.
Salamullahi al-kamilu al-tam Ash-shamilu al-am Wa salawatuhu al-da'imatu wa barakatuhu al-qa'imatu al-tammah على حجة الله ووليه في أرضه وبلاده وخليفته على خلقه وعباده.
In one of the letters that he writes to Sheikh Mufid, he tells us one of the ways that we can end the ghaiba and make his reappearance come faster. What does he say? He says that If only our Shias would come together with united hearts, number one. Number two, in order to fulfill their pledge and their promise to us. لَمَا تَأَخْرَ عَنْهُمُ الْيُمْنُ بِلِقَائِنَا. That blessing that they're looking for of meeting us and being with us, meaning the Imam, that would not be delayed.
So, can for sure we say that we are now, at this time, we are passing the life in end of time? I mean, because some of the signs have shown, for example, the massacre of the people, you know, and some other things, these deviations from the right path of Allah. One of the signs is that the people become weak during the end time, isn't it, in their religious beliefs. So, can we say that now we are passing life in end time, Shaykh?
One of the points that based on which we can say that we are in the Akhirah Zaman is Ba'athatu, last messenger.
Okay.
I mean the coming or the advent of Islam, which is the last religion.
Yes.
and the Prophet of Islam, who is the last prophet, the seal of the prophets. Yeah, it is one of the signs that tells us that we are in Akhir al-Zaman.
So the beginning starts with the advent of Islam, okay?
Yes, because the last prophet, the last religion indicates that it is the last, it is the end of the world. But the other signs that we see also lists the kind of, what we can say, spiritual crisis nowadays we do have. You know that now we have devil, or let's say evil kind of values, wrong values are being spreaded all over the world, like homosexuality, let's say irreligious kind of ideas, ideologies, thoughts, values, principles are followed by majority of the people in the world. We have like battles, wars in the world. Yeah, this sort of things we have sometimes, difficulties, challenges, masaib we have in the world. But Khuruj al-Sufyani, that Nida, or let's say the reappearance of Imam al-Asr, descendants of Isa alayhi salam, and of course Ya'juj and Ma'juj who will attack, Raj'a returning. These are some other signs that we do not have till now. But at the end, what we have is that there would be a kind of universal peace, universal security, universal prosperity in all the world.
That's right.
That the last Imam with his companions will provide us with that sort of stability, peace, and progress in the end of life.
And consider that we as Muslims now, we are passing in end of time. Will our lifestyle will be different from the previous generations of the people? Or, for example, are there any special responsibilities or duties for those believers who are passing life in end time?
According to Riwayat, the Holy Prophet said that those people who can save their iman at the Akhir al-Zaman, they are among the best, let's say, people. They are among the best faithful people and followers of true religion. It shows that, it indicates that the means by which we can be misguided is increased considerably at the end of the time.
Yes.
For example, the previous generations, the followers of previous prophets, they did not have access this easily that nowadays people have access to all the things, according to this, on the cyberspace, on, let's say, internet, whatever, you see that nowadays the young generation could be very easily misguided.
Yes.
Because they have easily access to all, let's say, the means of misguidance.
Yes.
That's why it shows that, yes, Akhir al-Zaman is the challenging time and the most difficult and hard time to stay mu'min.
Yes.
To save our iman. Because of this, the Prophet says that those people who can safeguard their iman against the evil things at the end of the time, at Akhir al-Zaman, they are the best people. Yeah, this is the main difference between our generations and the coming generations to the previous generations.
That's right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, please visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Inna fil jannati nahran labani Ali wa Husayni wa Hasan. لعلي وحسين وحسان إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسان لعلي وحسين وحسان كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن.
Welcome to Israel Watch. On this episode, we will monitor the course of the aggression against the Gaza Strip and the failure to remove the resistance in light of the discrepancy between Biden and Netanyahu over the management of the aggression and the disagreements within Netanyahu's administration. We'll also go over the Zionist fear about the exacerbation of the situation in the holy month of Ramadan. On these topics, I welcome Mr. Ali Murad, the political researcher and writer. Welcome, Professor. Let's start with this. Although Iran corrected the Hebrew media's allegations about an Iranian presence in the Gaza Strip through the Iranian Red Crescent, and Tehran confirmed that Iranian aid was brought into the Strip through coordination with the Egyptian Red Crescent, Zionist commentators began to fear this step. Professor Ali Murad, why do the Zionists insist that the entry of Iranian humanitarian aid into the Gaza Strip, which is primarily in coordination with Egypt, represents an Iranian presence in the Strip, knowing that dozens of countries usually send such aid as we see?
Well, of course, since the beginning of the Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, since the first hours, there has been an attack of accusations against the Islamic Republic of Iran. And we witnessed that in the speech of Netanyahu and all the Zionist political elite, and at every station. They are trying to target the Islamic Republic of Iran, and I believe that the Zionist regime in general is trying to impose a fait accompli on the Gaza Strip so that in the next stage it can completely isolate Palestine from the rest of the axis of resistance. This is a central goal for the war administration. Therefore, they will try to target anyone would make this Israeli effort fail. Yes, it is a very good thing that the Islamic Republic of Iran's aid succeeds in reaching the Gazans. This destroys all the enemy's attempts to isolate the Gazans. Gaza is the incubator of the resistance and depicts the depth of the axis of resistance.
There is a lot of talk in the Hebrew media these days about Majid Farage, the head of the intelligence in the Palestinian Authority, because he is, according to this media, qualified to build an armed force from the families and tribes of Gaza to manage this part in a civilized manner, and it was revealed that he has met with a group of senior Zionist security officials. The Hebrew media talked about Majid Farage's meeting with Hagenbi, which was preceded by a heated discussion about Netanyahu and Gallant within the War Council, about the role he could play with the Palestinian Authority in distributing aid in the Gaza Strip. Professor Ali Murad, in your opinion, do you think there is a role for Majid Farage in the Gaza Strip or even Mohammed Dahlan, as we saw as Minister of War Gallant said under the main title distribution of aid?
It is true and clear that there is a Zionist attempt to seek help from those two figures or any of them. It is clear that they have no problem in the sense that they are reassuring for both parties. By Majid Farage and Mohammed Dahlan, Netanyahu is trying to play a game that he does not want anything from the Palestinian Authority. He does not want to allow its return to the Gaza Strip because they are concerned that they will fail in the process of suppressing the return of the resistance movement and the resurgence of the resistance factions. I believe that in the coming period, we will hear more about the role that Majid Farage will play in this context. Of course, there is a very great deal of acceptance with Mr. Majid Farage and also with Mohammed Dahlan. And there is practically a competition between which party plays a more important role. But for Majid Farage to meet with Hanegbi, the Israeli war advisor, this means there is a preference for Israeli expansion, preferring to work with the intelligence services directly affiliated with the authority. Yes, Dahlan may have a complementary role in another route through the Emirates, while the well-known side means Majid Farage represents the authority that is included within the official directions of the Arab League, Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt.
It is clear that the campaigns against the Netanyahu administration are continuing with force from its opposition, as former Minister of War Victor Berman called for its overthrow because the war is over, as he puts it. In addition, the Israelis have no choice but to go to new elections to overthrow the bad and dangerous Netanyahu administration. This is what the head of the Zionist opposition, Yair Lapid, called for. If the elections were held today, Gantz would gain a lead over Netanyahu. This is what a new Israel poll showed. Mr. Ali Morad, there are calls for elections by Lapid and Lieberman, and also the opinion polls clearly indicate that Gantz has a lead over Netanyahu. Do you think that it is actually possible to go to elections in light of the failure to achieve the declared goals of this aggression against the Gaza Strip?
It's clear that there is an American tendency in the Biden administration that the collective interest is to go to early elections in the sense of overthrowing Netanyahu, overthrowing his administration, and setting an early date for the elections. For the Americans, they consider that there is a danger to interests today represented by some of Netanyahu's policies. Therefore, on the issue of, for example, going to Rafah, they oppose it because they know that if Netanyahu goes to Rafah in 4 or 6 weeks, he will come out and say, "I have achieved a decisive victory militarily, and I'm not obligated to sign anything within the political project." So they have now launched the attack. We witnessed statements from within Washington that were met with statements from within the Zionist regime, Lapid, Lieberman, and all of these, even summoning Gantz to Washington, is in order to try to float him and market him as the right man to repair relations with America.
Indeed, with the opinion polls favoring Gantz's lead over Netanyahu, a campaign emerged by some politicians, represented by the coup of Gideon Sa'ar, head of one of the Zionist parties, against Gantz, and demanding that he should join the war council. So what effect will this coup by Gideon Sa'ar have on Gantz, and how will Netanyahu exploit it politically?
First, we must pay attention to the issue of Gideon Sa'ar. He grew up alongside Netanyahu and is therefore Netanyahu's dark horse. When he broke away from him years ago and joined the so-called international camp towards Gantz, it was destined at a certain stage for Netanyahu to return him towards himself so that he would break the reaction to Gantz's trip to the United States of America and what he said there and this American attempt to market Gantz as the strong man. Now, Netanyahu responds to his blows through his charm, thus showing Gantz that you are nothing. I can dismantle all the orientation that you are trying to build in an interview.
While the occupation leaders continue their threats to remove the resistance in the Gaza Strip, they were surprised by two Palestinian resistance fighters who were diving, coming from the Gaza Strip, across the sea towards the Zakin settlement in the Gaza Strip, which has caused a state of terror reminiscent of the Operation Al-Aqsa flood. The occupation army cannot control the Gaza Strip and establish military rule there, as ministers in Netanyahu's administration called for after the end of the aggression. This was confirmed by one of the former Zionist generals. The soldiers of the occupation army in the Gaza Strip are tired and desperate, and talk of an attack on Rafah is not in the interest of the Israelis. This was expressed by one of the commentators in the Hebrew media. With regard to the arrival of resistance divers to the shores of the Zakim settlements and the fatigue of the occupation soldiers, the inability to attack Rafah and the military control over the Gaza Strip, what is the military reality like in the Gaza Strip?
This means that there is an attempt by the resistance to tame the enemy by putting pressure on the public psychologically. The Israeli public, the public that is still lining up behind Netanyahu, or most of them are lining up behind Netanyahu and are still supporting him in the continuation of the war. The resistance is in fact telling them that unlike what Netanyahu has told you about cleaning up and settling the north, now this is a clearing operation from the Gazan land to the sea to Zikim. As the Zionist correspondent pointed out, this indicates that they have restored the scene on October 7th. This means that everything you did during the past 5 to 6 months has been in vain and you have not achieved anything. Hamas still has its capabilities. You say you have destroyed Hamas, and then you say you have destroyed Hamas's capabilities. But Hamas proves to everyone that their capabilities are still preserved. And therefore, this would put the ball back in the Zionist court, creating a debate that grows within the opposition bloc to stop the war. I mean, this war is absurd and has not achieved its goals. Amos Gilad, a former member of the planning department in the enemy army, says and advises, speaking in addition to other generals, that you cannot control this region. This region is finished, meaning it is no longer the way it was in 2005 when you left it, when you withdrew from it. There is great resistance that will occupy you and exhaust you.
Therefore, skepticism about the ability of the occupation army to achieve victory over the resistance in the Gaza Strip is accompanied by the confirmations about Hamas's victory and the occupation's defeat in the eyes of the world, which today focuses on the beginning of the month of Ramadan and its effect on the path of aggression. To the Israeli social media sites that responded to this statement, these are some of the comments.
Yes, I agree that Netanyahu is procrastinating the war because of his greed and does not care about returning the captives.
Timur.
They're all politicians and their leaders are enemies who are playing with us.
Nuiyuson.
The truth is that the biggest reason for our failure in the war is Netanyahu.
Niv.
Netanyahu creates division and hatred among the people.
Liron.
There's no greater enemy of Israel than Netanyahu.
Professor Ali Murad, how do you explain the call to seize the opportunity of the current American administration to make an achievement against the axis of resistance in the region?
This shows the importance given to this approach and seizing this opportunity, because what Biden presented today was not presented by an American president before him. He is the one who chose to visit Israel at the beginning of the war. And this has not happened before. None of the American presidents visited the enemy region at such a time. This indicates the depth of the commitment that Biden has, commitment to the security of Israel and the survival of Israel, and for Israel to return to its feet and all of these things. Today, there are groups within the Zionist regime that tell the Netanyahu administration that they see in the Americans in the current administration a savior and a guide who can be followed, in contrast to the choices that Benjamin Netanyahu wants to take them to, most of which stem from his own personal interests. This trend is growing. We are watching on the television channels, especially channels 12 and 13. There is a focus on this point, meaning that if we continue in this manner, we will lose the United States of America permanently.
The relationship between Biden and Netanyahu became tense after the U.S. intelligence reports indicated that Netanyahu cannot remain prime minister for long. The emergence of this dispute between Biden and Netanyahu will not only harm the relationship between the two sides, but may harm American arms shipments to the regime. Professor Ali Murad, the CIA report regarding Benjamin Netanyahu, in your opinion, will it really affect U.S. arms shipments to the regime?
Biden dismissed this idea since the beginning of the war, in the middle of the war, and until recently yesterday, that he will not allow arms shipments to Israel to stop. This matter is settled. The issue here only deals with the person of Netanyahu and Biden, who has been trying for some time to address the Zionist public and say to them, I care about my paternal feelings towards you, I care about Israel's security, and this concern for Israel's security and Israel's survival pushes me to differentiate between Israel's security interests and Netanyahu's interests. What was stated in the intelligence report on security threats regarding Netanyahu specifically is clear that it is a great light for a current within the regime to take actions. It is saying to them that now is an appropriate time for you to begin your movements against Netanyahu because Biden does not want to put pressure on him directly. He prefers this pressure to be exerted on him and his affiliates from within the regime. Therefore, he says these things that we have sovereignty and we're moving and we're not a banana republic and all this talk.
Writer and political researcher Professor Ali Murad, thank you very much for your participation in this episode of Israel Watch, and thank you for your good follow-up. Take care.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life. فرمود بعثتُ لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. And this is your host, Brother Mustafa. On this show, we discuss Islamic ethics and morality and what steps we can take towards reaching God, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You know, what are some practical steps in Islamic ethics and spirituality? And it's difficult to, you know, talk about this topic and not speak about one of the most important pillars of Islam, of Islamic spirituality, and that is, of course, Salah, our prayers, our daily prayers, and those recommended prayers that we have in our life. Prayers, it's something that we do every single day, and they sort of become a habit for us. And many times that we don't necessarily always feel that connection to God through our prayers. Whereas we're told that prayers are the most important pillar of Islam, we're told it's the best way to reach success. For example, in the call to prayer in the Azan, it says, you know, Hayya ala salah, hurry to prayer. We're told Hayya ala al-falah, hurry to success. Hayya ala khayr al-amal, hurry to the best of actions. I remember there was a phase maybe in my own life where I started questioning, you know, why am I praying? It's something that I was doing every day and it became a habit. When you turn to the Holy Quran, you will start seeing how important prayer is as a means of reaching God. When you start looking at the narrations of the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt, you'll see how much they emphasize the prayer. Some practical ways that potentially that I can offer that can help you to improve your prayer. You know, one is realizing that prayers themselves is a way of connecting to God. It's a way of connecting the seen to the unseen. We have verses in the Quran which use words, you know, the word wasl, for example, is used in prayers. And wasl, again, means to connect. It's just a way of, for example, the analogy that's many times used is, you know, when you call someone, when you connect to the internet. If you're not connecting, if you don't have the right connection, then, you know, that then let's say you're calling someone on WhatsApp and you're making a video call or a audio call and the connection is weak, they're not going to be able to hear you that well, right? So we want to have a strong connection. And that strong connection can only occur, for example, when we are not committing sins, when we are purifying ourselves, and we're truly motivated towards reaching Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. One of the things that we can focus on is, for example, you know, is understanding the meanings behind the actions of our daily prayers. So when we stand in prayers, we're told we're doing qiyam, and it's a way of straightening ourselves. When you see, for example, when a commander walks into, you know, their soldiers, you'll see they'll automatically stand up straight. They'll stand up, you know, they won't slouch. They'll be standing in an attentive position. And this is what we're also doing when we're standing in a position. And when we read, for example, Surah Fatiha, the opening chapter of the Holy Quran, this is a way of telling us, you know, you're now connecting to Allah, the Almighty. We're sending our praise to someone, you know, so focusing on the meanings of Surah Fatiha while we're standing in that attentive position and focusing on those meanings will definitely help us make a better connection to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Similarly, when we go into the ruku, you know, when we have our hands on our knees, that also is a way of connecting to God. And I'll speak a little bit more about that once we are back from the break.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. So I need. So I need. All I need. Oh. All I need to be all so I can be. And I know that you see how much you mean to me. Cause your love is all I need to be all I can be. And I know that you see how much you mean to me.
Love is all I need.
And we're speaking about the importance of prayer in Islamic spirituality and a step towards reaching God. We spoke about, you know, doing qiyam when we're standing in prayer. It's a way of straightening ourselves and straightening our lives. That's what it's symbolizing. Now, when we go into the ruku, one of the things that we're told is to stretch our back, right? Is to make our back extremely straight. In one of the sayings, Imam Ali says, you know, straighten your neck, stretch your necks in a way as if you're offering your neck to God. One of the physical impacts of stretching ourselves is that it stretches our spine, right? It stretches our back. Now, there's a book, you know, a psychology book. If you go look it up, it's Our Body Keeps a Score. I think that's the name of the book, or The Body Keeps a Score. And it talks about how when we emotionally suffer, those emotions can get converted into, for example, bodily pains. For example, you'll see that sometimes when people are stressed, they'll have neck pain, they'll have shoulder pain. Many times it's back pain or lower back pain. One of the impacts of stretching ourselves in ruku is stretching that area, our back, right? And that can help release, for example, many times negative emotions. If you look at some of the verses of the Holy Quran, when it talks about doing ruku, it also talks about, for example, giving zakat or doing tazkiyah or purification of our soul. When we're doing ruku, God purifies our souls. He says He removes the burdens of sins from our back. So these actions in our prayers, they're not only just physical actions, they're having a spiritual impact on us as well. And when you do ruku in this way, when you spend time, you know, when you spend, let's say, your ruku is a bit longer, when your hands are on your knees and you stretch your back, you spend time, you'll feel your body will stretch and relax, right? You will feel looser, you will feel lighter. And if you're not feeling that, then spend time doing that, you know, focusing on that aspect of ruku. The next step that we have in the holy prayer is that when we go into sujood, when we place our forehead, you know, on the ground, and we're told, when we have our forehead on the ground, this is the moment when we're closest to God, right? This is the closest that we can become to God. And it's a time when God says that He sends His rahmah, He sends His mercy upon us. A very interesting thing that a speaker once noted about this position is that it is very much similar to the position of a baby when they're in the womb of their mother. And interestingly, in Arabic, the word used for the womb of the mother is rahim, right? And in Arabic, so every word comes from a root word. And the root word comes up with different words which are related to each other. So for example, rahim is very much related to the word rahma because they both have the same root word. So I would say that when God is saying you're in sujood and you are, you know, He's sending His rahma on us, you are becoming purified just how, not only are you being purified, your spirit is being made just in the same way a baby is being made in the womb of the mother. God is giving you that mercy and rahmah that a child receives from his mother. You're receiving it from God in that position of sujood. So concentrating on all of these actions and aspects of our prayers will definitely help us improve, you know, our spirituality, will definitely help us reach God. One final point I want to wrap up on is one of the things that we talk a lot about is concentration in prayers. And many times people are doing different exercises to help themselves concentrate, and that's all really good. However, I would say concentration in prayers is an automatic process. It is something that should happen automatically. It is a result of, for example, of not committing sins. It's a result of keeping yourself purified throughout the day. When you do come and stand on that prayer mat and in front of God, your heart is ready to really love God, and He automatically places love and light in your heart that you don't even need to think about concentrating. It will happen automatically, inshallah. Thank you so much for listening to this episode, and please continue listening to IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share, he knows.
Everyone has a beloved, and you, dear friend. But I have you, my dear. May God protect you, my dear. May God protect you.
IRIB English Radio, for those who seek the truth.
Rabbana, Rabbana.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
Rabbana, Rabbana, ya Rabbana, ya Rabbana, ya Hayyu, ya Qayyum, nawwir qalbana.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be asking a question which is very significant and pertinent, and it's related to the time we are currently in. In the month that we are passing through, and that is the month of Ramadan. As you know, the month of Ramadan is a very important month in the Islamic year. It is the most important month of the Islamic year, in fact. And on behalf of IRIB English Radio and The Key, we would like to offer our esteemed listeners congratulations on this very auspicious and blessed month. The question that we want to ask is this: why is the month of Ramadan so significant for Muslims? Why is it so significant and important? In some of our previous sessions, we have examined the reason for this, some of the reasons for this. One of the reasons, perhaps the most pertinent reason, was the fact that the Quran was revealed in the month of Ramadan upon the heart of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And this is, you know, the Quran obviously is the guidance for mankind, guidance of human beings towards that which is best for them in this world and in the hereafter. This was one of the significant aspects of the month of Ramadan. Another important aspect was that in the month of Ramadan, the doors of repentance are opened, and the chances of our repentance being accepted are more than in that of other months. Another important aspect of Ramadan was the fact that in Ramadan, we're obliged to fast. And fasting, in contrast to other months, fasting is obligatory in this month. Today we're going to be looking at another very significant aspect of the month of Ramadan. And that aspect is this: that in the month of Ramadan, a person's destiny is determined. Meaning, the events that will transpire throughout the year are ordained and destined in the month of Ramadan. Depending on how we act in this month, right? You know, how we act in this month will determine what will happen to us and will transpire with us in the month of Ramadan. That, and this is very general. It not only includes the sustenance, our sustenance throughout the year that we are going to be given. It also determines our lifespans, whether we will live or die. In this year, our life will continue or we will pass away. And other things as well. This is something which is attested to by a very blessed hadith from Imam Sadiq. Let's look at this hadith and let's see what it says. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, in his advice to his children, heralding the advent of the month of Ramadan, he said the following: exert yourselves in doing good deeds, for verily, in this month, sustenance is the part which is related to our topic. Sustenance is apportioned. Life spans are destined. The names of Allah's select servants who wish to strive towards Him are recorded down. Right, so this is one of the significances of this holy month. And to be more specific, and if we want to explain this a little bit more, this could be because in this month there is a night called the night of ordainment, the Laylatul Qadr, and that is a night which likely falls in the month of Ramadan, and in which our destiny for the remaining part of the year is ordained. And coincidentally, we would like to add here that one of the reasons why these spiritual wayfarers, the friends of God, they calculate the beginning of their year from the month of Ramadan is for this very reason. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the significance and importance of the month of Ramadan in the light of the Hadith and the Quranic verses. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, in the program The Key on RIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
In Gaza, we're no longer on the brink of famine, we're in a state of famine, affecting thousands of people. The words of EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell. Hello everyone and welcome back. I'm Saeed Pourreza. On this program, day three of ceasefire talks in Doha between an Israeli delegation and mediators from Qatar, the US and Egypt. The Qataris say they're cautiously optimistic, but a breakthrough is too early to talk about. Meanwhile, hunger has reached catastrophic levels as a result of the Israeli siege of Gaza. The World Health Organization says an increasing number of children in Gaza are on the brink of death from acute hunger. Canada joins the Netherlands, Japan, Spain, and Belgium in suspending arms sales to the genocidal Israeli regime. But several Western countries continue to supply lethal weapons to Tel Aviv, despite the enormous human toll and an imminent famine in Gaza. The bulk of those weapons, of course, supplied by the U.S., Israel's closest ally. After nearly more than 5 months of the genocidal campaign, the death toll is at least 32,000 and more than 74,000 wounded. With us for this edition of the program, in the studio, Dr. Imran Ali Panjwani. Dr. Panjwani is head of diverse legal consulting and a senior lecturer in law, and via Skype from London is Dr. Nihat Khanfar, who is also a lecturer in law and politics. Gentlemen, thank you for being here. I'd like to start with you, Dr. Panjwani, and it's become a tradition to really start with getting our guests' reflections on more than 31,000 killed, over 70,000 wounded, the scale of the death and destruction in the Gaza Strip, and of course, as I read earlier, the imminent famine that is facing the population there.
Yeah, thank you very much. I think two immediate points come to our mind. One is, since our last discussion, which was specifically about the ICJ ruling, there appears not to have been a follow-up there, or perhaps South Africa is trying to do that. And so there doesn't appear to be legal limits based on international law to stop the genocide, to stop the massacre. That's the first thing. So legally, the first reflection I have is, how are we putting legal pressure on Israel? And number two is historically, I mean, this is the worst genocide since Rwanda. The death toll keeps rising. And even though we are in Ramadan and we are fasting, there doesn't appear to be any sense of humanity and decency to stop the killing and give food to people who are starving and also fasting.
And South Africa has recently asked the ICJ to do more, which is to call for a ceasefire.
Yes, exactly. But there doesn't appear to be a legal follow-up in terms of implementation of the court ruling, because they said, okay, you have this by this date to report. So, okay, what are the next legal measures? How are we going to enforce the ruling? I think these are the more fundamental questions.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Khamfar, we'll get to, of course, the core issue of the stumbling blocks to achieving a ceasefire, but can I just have your thoughts on how necessary and how urgent a cessation in violence is, especially as we heard Dr. Panjwani say earlier, during the holy month of Ramadan?
Well, we have to look at what Netanyahu thinks, as a matter of fact. We shouldn't really treat Netanyahu as a normal politician in this political world. We have to treat Netanyahu in a very unique and specific case, because he wanted to position himself to be the man that he can break all the political red lines and sending a message to all world that I am the one really that you can't expect me to stop at any of these red lines that you have promoted or you have drawn for any other politician in this world. And of course, Netanyahu in this case, because he always promoted himself to be the man of security, failing to deliver on that, he feels that he has really to do anything just to have any caption of victory. And it seems to be all what he can really do in that regard is just really killing more Palestinians and putting all his efforts to weaponize anything he can does, even challenging the American administration, Biden administration. It's coming in the same context. It is all about how Netanyahu is trying really to promote a new design of his own image, political image, in order just to send a message for his own fascist extreme right voters to tell them, I am the man who can really do whatever he wants just to protect so-called Israeli security.
And total victory, I think, is the phrase they have used against the resistance group in the Gaza Strip. Well, let's talk ceasefires now. Qatar says it remains cautiously optimistic about the possibility of reaching a ceasefire agreement between the resistance group Hamas and Israel, and that it's too early still to announce any successes. Foreign Ministry spokesman Majid Al-Ansari says Israeli Mossad intelligence chief David Barnea has left Doha and that technical negotiations are ongoing between Israel and Hamas, with Qatar once more playing mediator between the parties. Well, here is Majid Al-Ansari addressing journalists at a news conference in Doha.
I don't think we are at a moment now where we can say that we are close to a deal. We are, as I said, we are cautiously optimistic because the talks have resumed, and that is a good thing, and we hope that that continues, and we hope to build upon that in the coming days, but it's still too early to announce any successes. First of all, to put you all at ease, he has left Doha, according to the information I have, and the technical teams are still meeting here in Doha. We do believe, of course, and we have said this countless times, that any attack on Rafah would hamper any efforts to get a deal. It would be a humanitarian catastrophe within what is happening right now in Gaza. We are talking about around 1.5 million Palestinians crammed into 10% of Gaza. We already have surpassed the number of 31,000 dead as a result of this war, and an attack of such magnitude will result in major death and destruction that cannot be justified by any tactical justifications that are being presented.
All right, the Qatari Foreign Ministry spokesman there. Dr. Panjwani, you mentioned earlier, of course, the lack of any action in terms of implementation as per South Africa's mm-hmm. request of the ICJ calling for a ceasefire. What do you think are the most important stumbling blocks to reaching a deal now?
Well, I think the stumbling blocks are fundamentally political. So the issue is that within the Western Hemisphere, as you said, with the US and the UK, there isn't political support to put pressure on Israel, so the stopping of arms. Mm-hmm. With the implementation of the ICJ ruling, the theory behind international law, it sounds very nice. Okay, there you have the Genocide Convention, you have international human rights. International legally is known as a kind of tertiary or kind of supranational law. Mm-hmm. What that means is that it doesn't operate like a red traffic light. If you pass it, then you get a fine. Mm-hmm. Who are the international police? Who are the international safeguards that will, you know, slap you on the wrist and say, don't do this? We don't have that within international law. Oh. And the UN body is fundamentally political. So the stumbling blocks are that at the moment, the key players like US and UK are using political means to make sure that Israel is not held liable, despite what the legal text says.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Hanfar, you hear that there is, you talked about what, you know, to be able to think the way Netanyahu does, to know whether or not there will be a ceasefire, you'd have to see what Netanyahu has in mind, and you explained what he has in mind. But what is the significance of dissent within the Israeli war cabinet and public opinion, however minor that might be? We saw, for example, Gantz touring America, the U.S., Europe in recent weeks, apparently not coordinating with Netanyahu and all the rest of it. But what is the significance of that dissent in apartheid Israel as far as this genocidal war continuing? In other words, to what extent do you think that would make any difference to what apartheid Israel is willing to concede in these ongoing negotiations?
Sadly and unfortunately, the vast majority of the voters in Israel backing Netanyahu's policies of continuing the genocide or genocidal actions against the Palestinians. And this is one of the recent surveys in many, as a matter of fact, in many of the Israeli academic and journalistic investigations, the surveys saying that the vast majority of the Israelis backing up every single bloodshed happening really in Gaza and in the West Bank, simply because they see it a good opportunity and they have to seize it and to carry on what they have started. They started to, you know, ethnically cleanse the Palestinians from the northern parts of Gaza. And now they are fighting in the middle of Gaza, in Khan Yunis and Gaza City. So Rafah wouldn't be really a red line to them, especially now that we can sense some new kind of language in the U.S. mainly, kind of accepting what is gonna to happen in Rafah, but they are trying, according to them, just to, you know, to decrease the harm against the civilians. So instead of killing, for example, 5,000, they might be looking to negotiate about 2,000. Instead of killing 10,000, they might be looking at, you know, 7,000 or something like this. So in general, Netanyahu is really looking at what his voters are saying, in addition to one of the most crucial issues, which is, you know, something really is recognized by the international community now and by the Israeli analysts, which they are repeating this all the time. The longer war in Gaza against the Palestinians, and probably even to expand it towards the southern Lebanon, it would be really a very good political move to Netanyahu, because he would keep his political skin.
Yeah, that of course is the argument as far as Netanyahu, that the longer he prolongs the war, the longer he can stay in power, because he has charges against him, corruption charges and all the rest, and so it is in his benefit, to his benefit, to continue with this. But is it sustainable? I mean, surely there should be some acknowledgement that they haven't been able to, despite the fact that they've laid waste to the Gaza Strip and killed so many people, they haven't achieved any of their goals, the most important of which, as they claimed, was to take out the resistance. Yes. And we saw a video earlier on released by Hamas targeting Israeli tanks and taking out their troops in the Gaza Strip.
Yes, I think a lot of this rhetoric may be a facade. So when they say they want to take out Hamas, Hamas is a resistance ideology. You can never take out that ideology, can always resurface. And indeed, for Netanyahu's sake, it is good for him, because at the end of the day, he's using that as a common enemy that the Israeli people have that will enable him, therefore, to wipe out Gaza. Mm-hmm. So the issue, in my small view, is not that he wants to take out Hamas. Hamas is simply a means to annex land, which is what happened to Native Americans, it was what happened to Aborigines, the same colonial mentality. Annex land, extend Israel, and then build on that land and wipe out heritage.
So that's what we heard, sorry to interrupt,
yes.
The Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner,
yes.
saying it makes a great waterfront property.
I know. So the same clip.
And we know that he yes. and Netanyahu are buddies.
Yes, yes. So what I'm saying is that this is all about land and making sure one race is superior and can live in that land. Mm-hmm. That's what I... And so, is that I don't think he's really worried about the political fallout, because if he accomplishes this aim of annexation of land, well, will people forget about the charges? Perhaps. Will the charges be minimized? Yes. Can he use political leverage? Yes. Mm-hmm. Look at what happened to Tony Blair, George Bush. Same thing.
All about him, isn't it?
Yes.
All right. Let's keep the ball rolling. The death toll in Gaza, of course, is continuing to mount in the absence of a ceasefire deal. Asghar Khan, an independent filmmaker in London, tells us neither Israel nor the Western leaders have any real interest in reaching a ceasefire deal.
I believe the ceasefire has stalled because Israel don't really want a ceasefire. They want their side of the deal to be met for the ceasefire to happen, which is hostages being released, which Hamas has agreed to. But Hamas also wants its hostages / prisoners released who are being detained, imprisoned without charge. But Israel don't really want to do that. Hamas also want their civilians to return to parts of Gaza and want humanitarian aid through. But Israel don't want to meet that. And that's why the negotiations have stalled. The other reason why the ceasefires have stalled is because the international community, mainly America, Biden, the UK, Rishi Sunak, and all Western leaders, and even Arab leaders, or leaders from all over the world, are not condemning Israel. They are not sanctioning Israel. I mean, they are so powerful, and everyone knows America controls Israel. They created Israel, yeah? And they could go there with their armies and stop Israel from committing genocide, war crimes, apartheid. But they don't want to do that because they have ulterior motives, which is oil, gas. I mean, look, Rishi Sunak and many world leaders have invested in the very companies that many believe now are going to steal the gas from Gaza. So basically, the world leaders are not held accountable for what is being done, yeah? And they need to do more. And if that's not going to happen, what we need is we need new leaders. We need new candidates. We need new MPs and presidents who do care about humanity. Because at the moment, these world leaders only care about the rich elite and themselves. They don't care about the working class people. They don't care about the children starving, the children dying, you know, people using food banks. They just care about themselves.
Asghar went on to say that what is needed is a global anti-Zionist movement that will change the oppressed state of the world today.
They are trying to turn us into a totalitarian state now. They are trying to totally control us. And if anyone disagrees with the government or their views, basically they're just going to try and say that you're extremist, because they don't want people to fight back against this dictatorship regime that they are trying to enforce on us. to mobilize an anti-Zionist movement, we need to let as many people know as possible what Zionism is about and what Israel are doing, because there are still many